My name is Giancarlo, and I am involved in Calvary Kids and participated in Kids Week. Let's read our scripture this morning from Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All the things are full of awareness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing under the sun. Is there a thing of which said, "See, this is new"? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after.
Oh, great job, Carlos. Well, my name is Zach Thompson. I'm a pastor here at Calvary, but I have not been here for the last few weeks. We have two other locations, two other campuses, and one of the things that we get to do over summer is I get to travel to those other campuses, and it's cool being part of the worship services, but it's such an encouragement to hear what God has been doing, to get to share what we've seen God doing here, and it's such a great time, but man, there's nothing like coming back home. It's so good to be with you all, especially on this Sunday, what we call Kids Week Sunday, where we look back at all that God had been doing over the previous week and then get to share that with the rest of our church. We are a singular congregation. There are not subgroups. There are not silos. There's not a group that is better than others or worse off than others. We are a church that is in awe that God would work through any part of it. And if we got to see God working over this past week, and I think we did, we want all of our church to be able to experience that joy. We want all of our church to be able to help lead all of us in worship. And I'm so grateful for our kids who are willing to do that for us today. We're in a series that we're calling A Better Way, as we've been looking through the book of Proverbs, which is part of the Old Testament wisdom literature. The Old Testament wisdom literature, this would be the books of Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Songs. That selection of books tends to contain passages that end up being many Christians' favorites. Many passages that Christians will go to over and over again, that they learn from, that they dog-ear, that they write somewhere because they're so impactful for them. And that makes sense. These books contain some of the most modern-sounding passages, that they're addressing issues and concerns that we still have today, that they're tremendously practical. They give us clear instruction on how we navigate this life. They don't pretend that life is all rosy, but they contain the whole gamut of human emotions and experiences. Yet on top of that they're just catchy, and that helps to make them memorable. And for many of those reasons, we have been working through the book of Proverbs this summer. But along the way, we've been quick to throw out some disclaimers, some warnings as we're going through this book. And the main one being that Proverbs contains principles, not promises. That what we find in this book is not a guarantee of how life will always work out. And in fact, the best of all wisdom does not mean that the best of all results will always happen. And that's where there's one book in particular from the wisdom literature that's helpful to read alongside of this book. And that's the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, Ecclesiastes, my summary of it, at least for this series that we're in, Ecclesiastes shows us how do we live when wisdom fails. Because alongside Proverbs, we've been seeing what the world tends to look like, of what is typical of our experiences as we follow in the way God has for us. But my language is pretty soft there, isn't it? And that's because what we find with Proverbs, as much as there's guidance and direction and encouragement and practicality, as much as that is true throughout the entire book, there is never a guarantee that if we follow the ways, that it will produce what we want it to produce. That's why some people could say, I've done everything right. So why haven't things turned out right? I've learned all this wisdom. So why is that not translated to happiness? I followed the way that God has for me. So why did I experience difficulty when doing so? In the book of Ecclesiastes, the author of it, known to us just by the title of the preacher, he looks around at all in all that's in this world, all that ought to produce happiness, all that ought to result in goodness, all that ought to be so valuable and beautiful, and instead describes it with this word that's repeated throughout as vanity, meaninglessness, a vapor that you try to grab, but it just slips through your fingers. Let's look again at how the book starts in Ecclesiastes 1 through 4. Forgive me for not reading it as well as Giancarlo did. It says this, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanity, says the preachers. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Maybe just in looking at this passage, we're starting to pick up on why Ecclesiastes doesn't tend to be people's favorites as much as like a Proverbs or a Psalms. When we read a passage like this and things are going well for us, the reaction tends to be something along the lines of, lighten up, buddy. When things are going well for us, it's difficult to grasp the truth that Ecclesiastes shows us. I ran into this a few weeks ago. I was reading initially through the book of Ecclesiastes just in preparation for this, just was reading through it on my own. And I happened to be on a beach. And my son was playing in many of the same places that I grew up playing. And so it was this really special moment. My heart was so full. It was such a peaceful time, such a fun time to be there with my family. And so as I'm reading through the book of Ecclesiastes and I'm reading through chapter 9, what's not on the top of my mind, what it's talking about in that chapter is, we are all going to die someday, aren't we? When things are going well for us, it's difficult to grasp the truth of Ecclesiastes. But for those who are going through a hard time, for those who do recognize the limits of wisdom, for those who do see that the best practices that wisdom produces is just that, it's best practices, not guarantee. That's when we need this book. Maybe this comes in moments of despair, or when we're not feeling satisfied, or when we recognize the frailty of life, or when we're questioning, are God's ways for us truly good? That's when we need the words of the preacher. That's when we need the book of Ecclesiastes. But I would argue it's not just in times of difficulty that we need this book. That especially in a time like this summer, when we are going through the book of Proverbs, as we are gaining wisdom, as we're gaining guidance for life, as we're getting this practical instruction of how do we navigate this place, I think Ecclesiastes needs to be opened right there next to us as we're going through Proverbs. Because Ecclesiastes doesn't just help us navigate difficulty, but to see reality. More than any other book, perhaps, Ecclesiastes looks at this world for what it's truly like, for what it truly is, and shows us that truth. Let me show my work by walking through a few of the topics that we're covering throughout this series. So we looked at work. We looked at wisdom for work. How do we navigate well what God has for us? And we said work is a good thing. It's something for us to be doing with our time. It existed before sin entered into the world. Work is part of God's plan for his people. Why then is it so hard? Why can it feel so unsatisfying? Why can work be hard to find, even at times, if it's something we're meant for? And as we're asking some of these questions, our language starts to sound a lot like the preacher's in verse 3. What does a man gain by all the toil? We talk about wisdom for pride. And within that, pride is so often the taking of a good thing and just misdirecting it. This desire to matter, to have purpose, to be significant, to leave a mark in this world. Those are good things that God gives to us. To live a life, to steward well what God has for us. Those are good things. But if those are good things, then why does it feel like we're not doing any of that? Why can it feel like what we read in verse 4? A generation comes and a generation goes, as if we weren't even here. We talk about wisdom for how we speak, to use our language well, to recognize the impact of our words. But then why does it feel sometimes like verse 8, that our words are full of weariness? That even the best guidance and direction cannot guarantee the results that we want, even as we're trying to navigate life well. Or wisdom for money. How do we use well the resources that have been given to us? And to recognize that they're there in part to navigate this world, to experience satisfaction with the things that we have. But then verse 8, there's no end to our satisfaction. That the things we see, the things we hear, the things we put into our body, well, they never seem to fully last. They never seem to fully satisfy. There's just this need for more and more and more. Similarly, wisdom for pleasure. That God made this world good, that he put us in this place. He designed it the way that it is, not just random, but in part so that we would enjoy what God has made in this place. This place is for our pleasure in part. Why is pleasure so fleeting then? Look at Ecclesiastes 2, starting in verse 9. Ecclesiastes 2, 9 says, "So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward from all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, it was vanity, striving after a wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun." The preacher has all that anyone could have asked for in life at a higher degree than anyone else had ever experienced. He had power and money and influence. He had all the pleasures of the world, all the wisdom of the world, but it amounted to nothing. We looked at wisdom for boundaries, recognizing that the limits that God places in our lives are actually a good thing. But then later on in chapter 2, the preacher looks around and questions, well, if those who are following God's wisdom and those who don't both meet the same fate, what's the point of it all? If we can't improve or prolong or strengthen the days that we have, what are we even doing? We talk about wisdom for navigating conflict well. Like, how do we interact with other people that we're at odds with? But then the preacher recognizes that, man, there's some things that just can't be resolved. There's some brokenness that just comes from this whole world being broken. And there's nothing that we could do to fix that. Ecclesiastes 4, verse 1. It says, "Again, I saw all the oppressions that were done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of the oppressors, you would think they'd be in a great spot. There was power, but they had no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who were already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not yet not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun." One of the hardest passages to read in the whole book. We'll talk about wisdom for navigating all kinds of different relationships. And we've been quick to say, and rightly so, that relationships are a good thing, that we're meant to be with other people. We're meant for community. And if this is something we're made for, though, why, in chapter 4, the preacher asks, why are so many people alone? Why are relationships so hard? Why, if this is something that we're made for, do they not seem to satisfy in the way they ought to? See, the role of the author of Ecclesiastes is looking at all there is in the world. That's this repeated phrase throughout. I saw, I saw, I saw. I saw all that there was under the sun, all that there was in this world, all that there was and anyone could have asked for, anyone could strive after, all that we could see and taste and feel, all of that. And none of it worked out. Instead of wisdom and goodness and righteousness always working in the way that they should, the preacher just saw vanity. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11. It says again, I saw that under the sun, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. It's at this point that my fears of this being a bit of a bummer sermon seem to be coming to fruition. At least that would be the case if that's all that Ecclesiastes had for us. Wisdom is going to fail, and there is nothing you can do about it. But that's not the teaching of this book. Now, I'll confess, Ecclesiastes is a really difficult book to read. It is so unlike anything else that we have, and that's why I think it's so good for us. But because it's difficult, many people approach it as a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. What you want to get out of it, you can quite easily get out of it. Are you a cynic? The purpose of life is that there is no purpose. It's all going to break and fail. You can point to different parts of Ecclesiastes and say, see, I was right. It's all meaningless. It's all vanity. And you would be able to walk away, yeah, maybe not feeling happy, but you could be right, at least according to your reading. Are you a hedonist? That life is just about the pleasures that you can experience within it. There's different passages that you can go to, a fraction of the book, and say, yeah, see, it's all absurd. It's all going to crumble. It's all going to fail. So you might as well just try to feel good in the midst of it. See something beautiful. Make something beautiful. Experience some joy that will take you out of the hardship of life. That's all there is. Or any number of philosophies that try to navigate the goodness of this world, but also the difficulty that's so easy to find in the midst of it. All of them could point to a part of Ecclesiastes and say, see, I was right for believing the way that I did. Life is absurd, so just rebel against it. Be good for goodness sake. Life is hard, so just pretend that it's not. Bury your head in the sand. There's so much pain in this world, so you got to try to find an out. Yet each of these miss something that's so crucial to the book. Then they miss the pattern that is there all throughout, where the preacher says, I saw and nothing under the sun. I saw and nothing in this world. I saw and there was nothing that was tangible or immediate or what I could find that produced any meaning. That is the key. See, if there is nothing under the sun that gives meaning, then we need to find something over it. And this interpretive key is dropped all throughout this book. It's found especially in the last chapter or two, but it's even given to us fairly early on. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, after quoting the band The Birds, this is what the author says. So turn with me to Ecclesiastes 3, 9 through 15. It says, what gain has the worker from his toil? I've seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He's made everything beautiful in its time. And also he has put eternity into man's heart, this longing for something beyond what we can just see, eternity into a man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from beginning to end. God's not exhaustible still. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. Here we go. This is God's gift to man. See, we return to the very question that was posed at the beginning of this book. What does a man gain from all his toil? What's the point of all the labor, all that we're trying to do, all that we're trying to experience in this life, if it's all just going to lead to vanity, if it's not going to produce anything that lasts, if it's not going to give meaning or purpose, what's the point of it all? What's to see this one who is not under the sun? Is to see that God has made things beautiful. God has given us joy. He's given us work to do. God has put something in the heart of every single person to long for more than just what we can see and taste and touch and feel. He's given us this longing for something that lasts, that's eternal in every single person. God's given a desire for joy, to do good, to find pleasure in this world because that last clause says, this is his gift. It's all a gift. I think if we can ever get to a point that we can wrap our minds around it, or even just get a fraction of what this is telling us, just a little hint at what it's showing us, it will radically change how we experience this world. And it's not because this has given us a new perspective to think about the world. This isn't just telling us to, man, if we could just think these happy thoughts in the midst of difficulty, that's going to carry you through. No, it won't. It will fail. What we need is not a change of perspective. What we need is not some thought to go through our head. We need reality. And the reality that's given in this book, what is shown to us to be real, is that all that we experience, all that we have in this world, is a gift from God. And what that means then is life is not about in the getting of the stuff. Life is not in just the things that are immediate to us. Life is not to be filled with getting as much of this world as we can experience, but instead to see that the God who's behind it all is our genuine satisfaction. It is all given as a gift so that we would look behind it to the one who gives the gift. Let me show my work by, again, talking about some of these topics that are showing up in this series from Proverbs. So, work. Work is something that is a gift from God. Yes, it's hard. Yes, it could feel meaningless at times. Yes, it doesn't satisfy in the way that it ought. But if we recognize work is a gift from God, that allows us to not see work as our everything. I just got to go and do more and more and more. I got to keep driving until my body breaks down. My life is wrapped up in what it is that I do. No, when we recognize life is, or work is a gift that's given to us, what we get to see is that it is a place where God is shouting to us, you have a purpose. You have something to be doing. You have something to where I have given it to you. See the goodness that's behind it. Yes, work in a broken world will never be as easy as it ought to be. It will never satisfy in the way that it should. But if we recognize that it is a gift that's given to us from God, not an end in itself, not an ultimate thing, but a gift given from God, that allows us to not rip our hair out at the seemingly meaninglessness of it all, but and see that it is a place where God imparts meaning to our very lives. Or money. We talked about money, or even just general satisfaction. That there's never a level that we get to where like, yes, I finally got it. I'm happy where I'm at. There's always that, but what about a little bit more? Or a little bit more, or maybe more accurately, what about a lot a bit more? There's never a place where I finally arrived at satisfaction. There's always this desire, this need for more and more and more. But what Ecclesiastes is showing us, that rather than just life being about the accruing, the acquiring of things, but to recognize that it has been given to us as a gift so that we would see the one who gives the gift behind it. Similarly, pleasure. That life can just feel like there's so much pain around, so how do we insert pleasure into my life? Just grab all the stuff that makes me feel happy, or I can pretend the rest of it doesn't exist, but man, why didn't it work as much as it did last time? Why does it feel like I need to up the dosage? Why is this not working anymore? And it can feel like life is just, I got to get as much pleasure as I possibly can out of it. But it misses the point of these things that feel good. They feel good so that we would delight in them, so that we would delight in God through them. So yeah, eat good food. Enjoy relationship with people in a way that allows us to not say, what's the next thing? But in this thing that's been given to me, in this gift, how do I delight in God as I delight in it? The relationships that we have that never seem to fully satisfy, that never line up with the picture that we had for them in our lives, that marriages are hard, that friendships get lost. And if we are meant to be in relationship with other people, why is there so much difficulty in the midst of it? Well, if we see that the very people that are in our life are put there as a gift to us from God, that helps us to see the toil, the work that they take is so much worth it. What do we do when wisdom fails? I think there's some instructions, some principles that we can take from the book of Ecclesiastes that helps us to navigate this. As we're going through the book of Proverbs, as we're getting instruction and practical steps for everything that we experience in life, as we hear these topics like work and money, and we might say, yeah, I want to figure out how to navigate those well, and that's a good thing. But if we start to want to navigate them well because they're the things that we're focused on, they're our ultimate thing, well, it's always going to crumble. See, what Ecclesiastes shows us is that while there's so much good in this world, none of it can be controlled. None of it can be forced. None of it can be magicked into your life, even as we follow the guidance that God has for us. See, whether we're on one of the most difficult times of our lives, or this happens to be the best day that we've ever had, that will always butt into a reality that this is a broken world. And all the wisdom that we can have applied to a broken world can never result in guaranteed results or constant results. There is a variable there that is far too fluid, far too flawed to lead to something working out in the way that we always want it to. But it doesn't mean that there's not good in this world. It doesn't mean that there's not things that are a delight or that give us pleasure or that are fun or beautiful. But if life is all about the getting of those things, if what we're driving, what we're building our life around is those things, we're going to guarantee, the one guarantee that we do have is we'll end up in the same spot as the preacher and looking around and thinking, this is it? This is all there is? It's vanity. No, instead, second, there is a good God who has given us these good things. All this good that's in the world, rather than it being the thing that we're striving after, it's to recognize there is a God who acts. This broken world that is flawed, that is not good enough, that does not give us the satisfaction that we're so desperately fighting for, God steps into that place to act. God enters into this place that can feel like vanity to produce something that matters, something that lasts, to point to him. Now, I recognize whenever God acts in the world, it comes with a question. I think it's a fair question of why did God act in this way, but not this other one? I think that's always a fair enough question to ask. Always one to turn to God in the midst of it. But my fear in doing so is that as we come up with hypotheticals of what God could have done, as we try to tell God of a plan that we had that was better than his, as we think of what God could have done instead of what he did, we miss the very thing that we're told happens when God does act, that he does so as a gift, that he gives us all that we have. And if we're looking around at the what ifs, we're missing the gift in how God chose to act. What is produced by what he did? How is it pointing back to him? God steps into this world. He doesn't need to, but when he does so to provide a gift. In his excellent, excellent book on Ecclesiastes that came out last year called Everything is Never Enough, Pastor Bobby Jamieson put it this way. He said, but if you believe that life is good because life is a gift, and life is a gift because God gives it, and life is full of God things, good things because the Creator is constantly flinging gifts at you faster than you can catch them, then any meaning that you discover is catching up with that meaning. Any goodness you enjoy is scratching the surface of the goodness that life is. Any happiness you experience is a glimpse of the one who is happiness himself. And then finally, when wisdom fails, we recognize that this world is not what we need or want it to be, but God is. And so we fear him, we revere him, we cling to him. And this can be our permeating thought. This could be what propels us forward in life, no matter what we're facing. No matter the difficulties or the meaninglessness of it, or it just feels like vanity, this can be what helps us to go through life. Because we recognize that this one who is above the sun has entered into this place to take all that's meaningless, all that's vanity, all that doesn't satisfy, all that's fleeting, and will bring it into perfection. This is how the book ends. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. The end of the matter. All has been heard. This is a summary statement. So fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. See, this can be our perspective. Not because this is a mentality shift. Not because we're telling ourselves good things in the midst of hard times. Not because we're blind to what's going on around us. But we can know that this is true because it is reality. Because what this preacher, what this author of Ecclesiastes was looking forward to, what he was longing for, what would make sense of a world that seems like vanity, has already been put in place. What he was looking for has already been put on tracks that cannot be stopped, cannot be deviated. Because this God who is above it all, this God who is above the sun, did something that seems so meaningless, did something that seems from the outside is just pure vanity. As he decided, as this God above it all, to enter into this very place. This God who is above the meaninglessness of all that we find under the sun has joined in with us under the sun to make sense of this world. Jesus has come into this world to make sense of it. And so we trust in not the things that we see or taste or experience ultimately, but we delight in them. Delight in God through them. Because we know this God has come. We know this God is coming back, and he will make sense of all that's in this world, all that leaves us unsatisfied, all that's broken, all that's meaningless, all that doesn't live up to what it ought to be. You will take all of that and make it to where that is never our experience ever again. It is so hard to do justice to this book in the short time that we have together. I can't even do justice to the impact that it's had on me over this season of reading through this book. I started reading Ecclesiastes in a season that I was so desperate for the truth that we find here. It's far too easy in this world to fall for the trap of more. I gotta get more. I gotta do more. I gotta be more. That this perspective of stewardship or just navigating this world well can so easily fall into the trap of, no, I must, I have to do more. There's so much more out there. I have to be more. I have to leave a mark. All of this that just seems to just riddle so many people. And you're not immune to it when working in church ministry. It's so easy to have the language start off so good as, God, this is for you. To quickly turn as, I am doing this for you. To, I must do this for you. And then to wake up one day and realize that I've been saying over and over, almost like a mantra, I must do this, I must do this, I must do this. The brokenness of this world is so insidious. And so what we need is not a right perspective or a correct philosophy to try to navigate this life. We need reality. We need something that's real, something genuine when all else feels like smoke. When we look around this world and see, why isn't it satisfied? Why is it broken? Why is it so easy to turn away from what's true and right? Why is it so hard? Why does it feel so meaningless? This place is broken. Well, the preacher looks around and says, yeah, that's about right. But you're looking in the wrong spot. You're not going to find what you're looking for under the sun. Look to the one who's above it. Because he is the one who doesn't just give us all that we delight in this place, but he does so that we would see our delight is fully in him. What do we do when wisdom fails? Well, the only thing we possibly can do, look to the God who gave us that wisdom. Turn to the one who's given us all that we have. As the preacher ends here, or as the book ends here, to fear God and keep his commandments. That's not just the beginning of wisdom, but it's the whole duty of man and woman.